individual defendant appellees with the exception of Mr. Smith. Your Honor, I rise to introduce to the court Scott Schreiber and Alyssa Preheim from Arnold & Porter in Washington, D.C. Mr. Schreiber has been admitted pro hoc vice, and with the court's permission, to present the argument on behalf of the individual defendant appellees.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr.
Monahan. Good morning. I would like to introduce my colleague, Rochelle Sirota, Sirota & Sirota.
Good morning. Welcome.
And I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Crandon Capital Partners. May it please the court. This appeal presents a straightforward issue of the application of the rules regarding summary judgment. In order to grant summary judgment to the defendants, the Court of Chancery necessarily had to credit testimony concerning a claimed agreement of O. Bruton Smith, a majority shareholder, chairman of the board, and chief executive officer of Speedway Motorsports, Inc., a claimed agreement to return to Speedway profits he might obtain as a result of the property transaction the plaintiff challenged. Plaintiff's contention on appeal is that there is abundant evidence in the record contradicting that testimony. We submit that there is sufficient evidence in the record showing a factual dispute as to whether or not there ever was such an agreement. So I will turn to that evidence. I begin with a contract for the property, for the sale to Mr. Smith. That appears at pages 834 to 35 of our appendix. The contract does not mention the alleged agreement. When publicly traded corporations engage in transactions of a magnitude of $53 million, the operative contracts generally contain the material terms. The fact that the contract does not mention the claimed agreement is evidence that there was no agreement. But we go beyond that. The contract says in plain and simple language that there were no terms and conditions other than those set forth in its text. In that phrase, the contract expressly disclaims any agreement about future profits. The people who signed the contract are Mr. Smith and Brooks, the only two people to testify concerning the alleged agreement. Their signatures on that contract constitute their statement, made at the time of the contract, that there were no terms and conditions other than those set forth. That contradicts their later testimony, on which defendants now rely. This express contractual disclaimer is further evidence that there was no agreement at the time. We next point to the board resolutions approving the sale of the property to Mr. Smith. Those appear at pages 18 to 30 of plaintiff's appendix. Let me put that document in some context. From the start of the case, plaintiff's theory has been that the property sale to Mr. Smith was a self-dealing transaction approved by a board of directors with a majority of members who were either interested or lacked independence, and therefore the transaction was subject to entire fairness review. Throughout discovery, defendants did not contest that theory. After the testimony concerning the claimed agreement, defendants sought summary judgment, arguing that the alleged agreement demonstrated that Mr. Smith could not benefit from acquiring the property. The sale, they therefore argued, was not a self-dealing transaction and was subject to review under the business judgment standard. Contrary to that theory of the case, which they now espouse, the board resolutions they approved specifically referred to Section 144 of the General Corporation Law and characterized the property sale to Mr. Smith as an interested director transaction. That appears in the first whereas clause on page A20. The board resolutions, which are also contemporaneous with the transaction, are evidence that the defendants perceive the property sale as an interested transaction. That perception is completely contrary to the theory they have espoused in their summary judgment application. The board resolutions, therefore, are evidence that there was no agreement to return profits. Board resolutions have additional significance, and I will be frank to say that I only focused on this as I prepared for argument. An exhibit to the resolutions is the First Union letter opining on the fairness of the sale to Mr. Smith from the perspective of public note holders of Speedway's publicly issued notes. That letter appears at page 31 of our appendix. On page 32 of the appendix, in the third full paragraph, second sentence, there's the following passage, and I'll quote, "Speedway's management, has informed us that it is not aware of any current arrangements or agreements with respect to, and I'm skipping a few words, any subsequent sale of the assets by the buyer. That statement is also contemporaneous documentary evidence contrary to the testimony on which the defendants now rely. The statement refers to Speedway's management. As page 53 of our appendix shows, and that's a page from the company's 10-K, Speedway's senior management consisted of defendants Smith, Wheeler, Brooks, and Clark. Moreover, the board resolutions show that all the defendants were aware of the statement I just read from the opinion letter. The second whereas clause on page 29 of our appendix states that each member of the board reviewed the opinion and I'm quoting, has had the opportunity to discuss its contents with the officers of the corporation as well as with First Union Securities. Each defendant signed a written consent approving that resolution. Those appear at pages 23 to 28 of our appendix. Those documents, all contemporaneous with the sale to Mr. Smith, directly contradict the later testimony of Mr. Smith and Brooks concerning the claimed agreement to return profits. Taken together, the contract for the sale, the board resolutions, and the fairness opinion create a material issue of fact regarding the alleged agreement.
May I ask you a question?
Certainly,
when,
Your Honor.
I got the impression from your brief that when you were in, I guess, Mr. Smith's deposition and he started talking about this understanding, that apparently came as something of a surprise. And you mentioned that only Mr. Smith and the very last person who was deposed, whose name I've forgotten,
Mr. Brooks,
were the only directors who made any reference to it. Having learned, I realize this was at the end of the discovery period, but having gotten this potentially important new fact brought out, did you ask the court for an opportunity to go back and redepose the other directors?
We did not. For the reasons I've already stated, we believe there was documentary evidence in the record that created a material issue of fact. And at that point in time, we did not want to go to the time and expense of retaking, I think at that point, there would have been five other director depositions to take. We thought that there was a material issue of fact as to this critical testimony. I mean, frankly, coming at the time that it did, it seemed to us that it was, if you will, made up at the time. But we did think, based on the documentary evidence that we had, that we could show a material issue of fact as to the existence of that agreement. So from a litigation perspective, from an efficiency perspective, we did not perceive a need to go back and redepose other people. There's a further basis in the record to question the agreement testimony. None of the five directors who testified prior to Mr. Smith mentioned the claimed agreement. This goes to the question Justice Berger just asked. We submit that's also evidence that it did not exist. And again, I have to put that in some context. The defendant's theory of the case is that the property sale to Mr. Smith was a benefit to Speedway. They claim the sale relieved the company of a property that was adversely impacting its earnings while retaining any profit potential the property might have. If that were so, it would have been a material term of the agreement to any director's consideration of that transaction. Any director called to account in this litigation could reasonably have been expected to point to that purported agreement as justification for his approval of it. The fact that no one raised it in their depositions or any other way in the litigation, we submit is evidence that it did not exist at the time.
Mr. Monahan, how do you suggest we handle the argument that's made by the other side that one can't defeat summary judgment simply by contending that uncontroverted testimony is not believable?
We are not contending simply that uncontroverted testimony is not believable. In a summary judgment context, the evidence consists of the entire record, and we have pointed to three specific documents that are not only silent about the agreement but expressly contradict the agreement. That is admissible evidence that is in the record that is contrary to the testimony in which defendants base their summary judgment motion.
I don't mean to split hairs with you, but when you say contradict it, do you mean it's not consistent with it, and for that reason it contradicts it?
Yes, sir.
Flip the coin, is it not inconsistent with it as well? It just doesn't speak to it.
I think it is inconsistent with it. I don't think it is not inconsistent with it. Excuse me. I think it creates a material inconsistency that has to be resolved at trial. It is not our position that you simply can't believe a witness who says X. It's our position that when the totality of evidence in the record suggests that there is a basis not to believe a witness's assertion of X, you have to have a trial at which the witness is observed and heard to testify in order for the court to make a credibility determination. And as I've asserted, the documentary evidence we point to is the contract itself, which is A, silent, and B, expressly says there were no terms and conditions of the transaction other than those set forth in the text of the agreement. B, the board resolutions, which clearly treated this as an interested director transaction, and that's inconsistent with the theory of the case that's now espoused. And C, the fairness opinion itself, which expressly says that Speedway's management has informed First Union that they're not aware of any agreements relating to the subsequent sale of the property. So that is direct documentary evidence that is contemporaneous with the transaction, that is inconsistent with the testimony on which they rely. And frankly, it would be our submission that documentary evidence that was created at the time of the transaction is entitled to at least equal, if not more, dignity than testimony that comes 2 years later and is inconsistent with the documentary record at the time. So our fundamental position, Your Honor, is that there is documentary evidence in the record that creates a material issue of fact as to the principal assertion on which defendants rely.
I want to follow up on that for a moment. The contract itself says this is the complete agreement and there are no other terms, in essence, correct? And in that written contract, there's no reference to the agreement to return any profits?
Yes.
Okay. So that's your basis for saying that contradicts Mr. Smith's testimony?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Did anybody ever ask Mr. Smith, why isn't there anything in the contract about this?
No, that did not come up at his deposition.
Okay.
Now, and has the property subsequently been sold by Mr. Smith?
One property has been sold. The second property at the time of the argument was, I believe, under contract for sale. I think the other side can help Your Honor better on that. I think that second sale has been completed. I think it was said in one of the briefs.
So it's important for the court to know whether Mr. Smith has repaid the profit and whether this case is moot or not. Do we still have a controversy here?
It is Mr. Smith's contention, as we understand it, Your Honor, that he did not make a profit.
I see.
That when he was asked at his deposition how profit would be determined, he said, that's not up to me, that's up to accountants. And at least as of the time of the summary judgment argument, the representation to Chancellor Chandler was that the final tally had not been completed. But it's certainly clear to us that Mr. Smith is under a belief that there was no profit, which, frankly, in our view, makes it very safe to say that there was such an agreement.
Well, do you agree that there was no profit?
In a formal sense, Your Honor, we have not had a full opportunity to examine that. I can say to the court that in the context of certain discussions between the parties, we were given some information. We weren't able to satisfy ourselves as to that point.
So we may be dealing with something that's moot, but we're not sure.
I wouldn't say it's moot in any event, Your Honor, because if the fact is, as we believe, that Mr. Smith was able to purchase this property for less than it was worth at the time of the transaction, there's a damage claim there to be asserted on behalf of the corporation, regardless to whether he later made a profit or not. Because whether or not he was ultimately able to make a profit may depend on a number of factors affecting the marketplace subsequent to the sale. But from the perspective of the corporation, the critical issue as we see it is whether they got a fair price for the property at the time they sold it. We've submitted, and it's in our appendix, an expert opinion to the effect that the two properties together were worth, $72 million, $57 for the warehouse property and $15 for the land. He bought it for around $53.54. So there would be a damage claim there in any event. That part of it is not moot.
All right.
Well, I only have a few seconds left in my initial time, so on this point, finally, I would just urge the court to read Mr. Smith's testimony, which is set out at pages 10 to 11 of our opening brief. Mr. Smith first expresses uncertainty as to whether he communicated the claimed agreement to his board colleagues at all, and then uncertainty as to how he communicated it and when he communicated it. When Mr. Rota gave him the opportunity to tell his story straightforwardly, he was unable to convey it in a manner that creates confidence in its veracity. His inability to respond clearly and cogently to direct questions is evidence that there was no agreement. So taking it as a whole, Your Honors, we submit that there are material issues of fact in the record as to the existence of this claim agreement. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sparks.
Your Honor, please, the court. First, let me answer the court's direct question. The two properties have been sold. The amount of either profit or lack of profit is to be determined based on the year-end financials. That task has not yet been completed, but when it is, that result will be presented by my client, Mr. Smith, to the company's board of directors. They will either agree with it or disagree with it, and there will be a resolution. But that is the status. Both were sold, and the accounting, if you will, is in process based on the year-end financials. Audited information on the subject.
Is there a timetable for that?
I don't know the precise timetable, but we ought to be getting pretty close to that because we're up to March, and the closing of those books ought to be right about now. So it's my understanding it's going to be happening in the ordinary course, and I can't make a representation as to precisely when, but my suggested is around now coming up. As your honors have been able to observe, with one exception, the Smith agreement to repay profits, there's no challenge to the chancellor's fact-finding below. So I'm not going to go into the facts. The chancellor stated it better than I ever could. And as a result, this appeal does boil down to one narrow summary judgment procedural question. On that, I agree with Mr. Monheit. And it's based upon principles well established under this court's case law and the chancery court's rule. And that question is, when two defendants testify unequivocally at a deposition that there was an agreement by one of them with the board to remit to the corporation any profits from a challenged transaction, and the plaintiff, faced with that record, a motion for summary judgment in a two-year period to do something about it, chooses to stand on its pleadings and not further pursue discovery of the directors under Rule 56F, can it avoid summary judgment premised on the existence of that agreement? Because there's no disagreement that if that agreement exists, summary judgment was appropriate. That's not contested on this appeal. And the clear answer to that question is no. This court, way back in 1979 in the Feinberg case, characterized it as settled law. That's the court's words. Settled law as of 1979, that once a moving party puts into the record facts that if undenied entitle him to summary judgment, the burden shifts to the non-moving party to prevent countervailing evidence. And Feinberg, of course, rested on Rule 56E, which provides that when testimony under oath supports a deciding point and the adverse party does not respond with testimony by affidavit or deposition, summary judgment, quote, shall be entered against the adverse party. And in the Womack case and the Cook versus Zulie case, and as far as we could tell forever, the Court of Chancery has consistently followed Feinberg and the plain dictates of Rule 56E.
As I understand your position now and in the briefs, irrespective of the fairness opinion or these other agreements, to the extent they're inconsistent with Mr. Smith's testimony, he's taken the unequivocal position that he agreed to turn over the profit, and that's undisputed. And therefore, whatever the other agreements say, the final agreement is that he's not going to make a profit, and therefore summary judgment was appropriate.
That's correct, because under Sinclair, it removed the self-dealing aspect under the definition of self-dealing in Sinclair, and hence a business judgment examination was appropriate, and there's no appeal of the chancellor's finding below that there's nothing here to punch through the business judgment rule.
Wouldn't you agree that there is an inconsistency between the alleged existence of this agreement and the contract itself that makes no reference to it and says that there are no other terms or conditions relating to the transaction?
No. And I don't believe there's an inconsistency there or on the other two matters that Mr.
Mahai mentioned.
So can I go through those?
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, let's talk about the contract. First, while the promise to rebate any profits realized on the transaction was made personally by Mr. Smith, the Speedway, the real estate contract upon which plaintiff now rests its case, and by the way, this was not argued below. This is new in this court. This was not a theory below. But this inconsistency theory on the real estate contract upon which the plaintiff now rests its case is between a Speedway subsidiary, if you look at 834 and 35, which I would urge the court to do, because we're talking about a little form contract with a phrase that says terms and conditions, colon, none. Other terms and conditions, colon, none. That's all it says. And the contract is between a Speedway subsidiary and something called Las Vegas Industrial Park LLC, which is an LLC wholly owned by Mr. Smith. And reference to Mr. Smith's undertaking, his personal undertaking to the board, his personal promise to the board, would have been inappropriate in that bilateral agreement to which he was not personally a party. He signed it, but he signed it in his capacity as the LLC person. Second.
Well, wait a second. Let me see if I can follow this. So Mr. Smith, because he signed in the name of an LLC and not personally, would not have put his agreement with the company to repay
in this standard real estate contract.
In this
correct.
Contract for the sale.
Correct. I mean, he made his personal promise that if there were profit made on the sale, he would pay it back. He would pay it back.
What was
the
consideration for that personal promise?
The fact that there was an entry into an agreement with a company in which he owned 100% of, which is the LLC.
Wait, you lost me there.
He owns 100% of the LLC.
Right.
The company agrees. To enter into this transaction with his personal LLC, that is certainly consideration to support his reciprocal agreement back to the company that he would pay any profits back that would realize from the transaction. I'm just saying that they take it too far when they say that in this standard real estate contract in which he was not personally a party, that there is some inference to be drawn from the fact that the terms and conditions thing, which talks about is there insurance on the property, are the premises in good condition, and that sort of thing, wasn't mentioned. It was a separate agreement, a separate oral agreement, subsequently reduced to writing, actually, at the deposition, but it was a separate oral agreement, and there's no dispute about that. So this is not an inconsistency to not have it there. Second thing that Mr. Monheit mentioned was Section 144 and the fact that this is a 144 transaction. Well, 144 is a void for vague or a voidness concept under our law. It's not Sinclair. It's not. It may be an interested transaction for 144 purposes. That doesn't mean it's an interested transaction under our fiduciary analysis in Sinclair. And so there's no inconsistency there. And then they mention Appendix 31 and 32, where the banker is giving an opinion as to whether or not the transaction is fair. And there's reference to. No agreement about a subsequent sale of the assets by the buyer. Well, what that's all about, obviously, is that if the buyer was buying the property and it had an agreement to sell it to somebody else and flip it for a higher price, the banker would have wanted to know that. Once again, it's not what we're talking about here. And in all of these, they didn't ask any deposition questions. They didn't go back and test it. They chose for tactical reasons, as Mr. Monheit explained a moment ago, quite candidly, in the 2 years they had, and even after we moved for summary judgment, it was clear where we were relying on this testimony, to just remain silent and not go back and explore any of these areas, none of which are inconsistent on their face. So we have sworn testimony on the one side by two people. And under this court's decision in Moskowitz, just because my client is interested in the transaction in the sense that he's on the other side of it, doesn't mean that he doesn't get the benefit of people believing him when he swears under oath. That is not a basis for denying summary judgment. And when you get right down to it, that's really all they're saying here. Moreover, as my yellow light comes on, there is no challenge to the Chancellor's alternative ruling. At footnote 8 of his opinion, that under Sinclair, entire fairness does not apply because Mr. Smith did not seek the transaction, but as is undisputed, agreed to it as an accommodation to Speedway. They sought him out to help bail them out of a problem that was causing a real hit to their earnings, and he agreed to do it. And under that circumstance, also under Sinclair, not even challenged on appeal, there's no self-dealing. So for both of those reasons, this matter should be affirmed. Now, there's one other argument that's made in the brief, and since I have, I don't know, do I have any time left? I can't tell if it's late or not. I think I have 3 minutes left.
Right. You do have 3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Okay. There was a backup argument that the concept of profit was too indefinite to support a valid contract. That's in the briefs. That argument was not made below, and it's inappropriate now under Rule 8. Just wasn't made below. And second, the concept of profit is well defined as the excess of revenues over expenditures, and indeed plaintiffs makes no effort whatsoever to distinguish the Merimensky case in our brief, which enforces a contract to pay profits and interprets the term in accordance with its common parlance. Your Honors, I'm going to, in one of the rare instances where somebody doesn't tell me to sit down, unless the court has questions, I am going to sit down and turn the podium over to Mr. Schreiber.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I represent the directors besides Mr. Smith of Speedway. And I just want to turn to the simple fact that this is just not about Mr. Smith's testimony. It's also about the testimony of Mr. Brooks and some of the others. And Mr. Brooks gave undisputed testimony as to all the operative facts in this case, and it's just completely undisputed. He gave testimony about the company being forced to purchase this land and industrial park to begin with. He gave undisputed testimony about the companies not being able to sell it at any time, about the title problems around this thing, with the land having a problem with no access and with the park having a problem with no water, and that no other buyer would buy it because you couldn't pass a clear title and it would take time to remedy those things. Uncontested. He gave testimony as to the value of the property on the company's books. He gave testimony uncontested as to the pressure the company was receiving from investors and analysts to sell the property due to the fact that the carrying cost and the losses were affecting the stock. He talked about, again, uncontested in view of the last point just made, that it was the directors who approached Mr. Smith to buy the property. Three of the directors sought him out and said, you know, take this off our hands. It's depressing the stock. Mr. Smith was the largest stock, over 29 million shares, so that the fact that the earnings took a hit when that quarter earnings were announced, he lost, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on paper from this transaction at the time. So the directors went to him, said, take it off. He was reluctant. Mr. Brooks testified as to that in an uncontroverted way, that is, he was reluctant to buy it, had to be convinced to buy it, and then he said, okay, I'll buy it, and I'll also pay back any profits. This is not contested. Other directors have corroborated various portions of that, of seeking out Mr. Smith. It is simply not enough in this kind of a situation for the plaintiffs to say, if I would have asked Mr. Brooks X, he might have said Y, or if I would have asked Mr. Smith something, he might have said something else. That didn't happen. I was at those depositions, even assuming Mr. Smith, it was a surprise to hear this testimony. Mr. Brooks went on the next day. They had plenty of an opportunity to show those contracts to them, to ask the very questions that now are being posed with respect to why there was purportedly an issue of material fact. They didn't ask those questions. They could have asked those questions. That really is the end of it. And since the record is very clear here and the Chancellor's decision, in our view, very clear and crisp, unless the Court has any questions, I will sit down.
Thank you.
I think one issue posed by the argument that's been made is what constitutes a record on a summary judgment application. It is not, I submit, simply testimony. It is the entirety of the record, and that includes the documents. And those documents are admissible evidence. The explanations you heard from Mr. Sparks are simply that. They are explanations. They are alternative interpretations of the documents. Those arguments would make sense if we were standing here in a post-trial basis. But the question in this procedural posture of the case is, does the record show a material issue of fact as to the existence of this claimed agreement to return profits to Speedway? We offer one explanation for the documents that says these documents plainly show that at the time this transaction was done, there was no agreement. There's another very legalistic alternative explanation for that. That can be part of the factual mix of trial combined with the court's view of how witnesses testify in light of that contrary documentary information. But as we stand here today, the documents are contrary to the testimony, and there's a material issue of fact.
Well, if I understand where we are at this point, you started out saying that we've got testimony on one side, we've got documents that are inconsistent with that testimony on the other side,
yes.
Therefore we get past summary judgment. One of those documents is the contract, which makes no mention of the agreement with respect to profits. Mr. Sparks' response to that was, yeah, well, this is not a contract signed by Mr. Smith. It's signed by an LLC, and the agreement to return profits was a personal one between Mr. Smith and the company. Doesn't that kind of put the end to your saying that that document itself is inconsistent with there being an agreement?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't see how people can sign a contract that says there are no terms or conditions involving this transaction other than those set forth and say, oh, yeah, over here on the side we have this private agreement. I think that's an inconsistency. I think it's an inconsistency when they stand here today and say this wasn't a self-dealing transaction, and they specifically in the board resolutions invoke Section 144 and expressly characterized as an interested transaction. I think there's an inconsistency when there's a statement in a fairness opinion that says management has represented to us that there are no agreements regarding subsequent transactions involving the property. That's an inconsistency. They have an explanation for it, but that has to be evaluated in light of a fully developed record. I think each one of those is an inconsistency. I don't think, and I would add the point that Your Honor made, and our brief did go into this, so I don't have a lot of time to dwell on it, but if it was simply a side agreement just hanging out there, I don't think there was consideration for it. I think it's a gratuitous promise and it's unenforceable. And on the comment that was made about the enforceability argument not having been made below, there is a footnote in our opening brief, our responsive brief in the Court of Chancery that said very simply the contract wasn't enforceable. That issue never really got joined. Mr. Sparks' argument before Chancellor Chandler did make a comment to the effect these agreements are enforceable. So I think on the defense side they recognized they had to show enforceability, but it simply didn't get developed. But the point of enforceability was raised in that fashion. I don't think that if this was an interested director transaction at the time, if it was a self-dealing transaction at the time, that a subsequent agreement executed at a deposition to return profits can cure that problem. I don't think we can change the standard of review 2 years or a year or so after the fact simply when a witness decides at a deposition that he'd like to change the dynamics of the case. And finally, as to the Sinclair argument, it may be, I mean, the record certainly says that the other directors came to Mr. Smith and asked him to take this property, but if the facts are that he said, I took it, I will take it, but only at a price that is very favorable to me, I submit that is still a self-dealing transaction for fiduciary purposes. One other point, the comment is made repeatedly that we don't contest the Chancellor's fact-finding. In the summary judgment context, there shouldn't be fact-finding. We do have issues with how the case gets presented from the defense side. We simply haven't delved into those issues because they aren't material. The material fact here is to whether or not there was an agreement for profits. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you all very much. The court will take this matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.
Please rise.